Hey, this is episode 666 of the MacCast, so it's about to get weird for 15 seconds. Don't worry about it. I'm eating nothing, sir, for the visitor, but I'm going to eat it. That's it, just must have the mock. I'm eating nothing, sir. I'm a photo, MacCast, Tuesday, July 31st, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the MacCast. Hey, just having a little fun with you there at the beginning of the episode. Hey, lots of things happening in the Mac and Apple world this week. We had Apple's quarterly results call that just happened. We're going to be going over the numbers for that. We're going to talk more about the triple iPhone update. Siri getting a pretty good grade in some testing. I want to talk about that a little bit because you know I'm a Siri fan. Also going to talk about some possible issues with those new MacBooks, and I'm super excited about some new content that might be coming to Apple's new video service. So we've got all of that, plus some of your feedback. We're going to talk a little bit more about subscriptions and subscription pricing on apps. I've got a new perspective there from one of you. Going to talk about startup security and the T2 chip. Also, encrypted disk images. So we got quite a few security things to talk about. And actually, all security things to talk about, and we'll cover USB restricted mode and what that means for your iOS devices. So it should be a great episode. Stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, Text Expander is awesome for us personally, but guess what? It can be even more productive if you implement it at your office or your workspace, and you can do that with Text Expander for Teams. Basically, Text Expander for Teams multiplies your team's productivity, making up-to-date shared knowledge available instantly. Using Text Expander, all your team's common responses are accessible and searchable to everyone on the team through simple abbreviations and, of course, keyboard shortcuts. You can have them written and edited by the best writers on your team, so you get great communication every time. You have all of your snippets available on multiple platforms, macOS, iOS, Windows, even the web, so it doesn't matter what platform your team members are on or choose to use, and all of your stuff updates immediately everywhere when it's modified. So if you need to make a change to a bit of communication, everybody on the team gets that all at the same time using Text Expander for Teams. So what's awesome about this is you can set up teams for all of your various departments, and within those departments, then share your snippets. So that allows you to do things like unify your communication from, say, your sales department or your support teams, or imagine the amount of time you're going to save maybe in your IT department handling things like support emails or common troubleshooting questions you might get from your users, or sending out setup and configuration instructions for internal software or applications or things that need to be configured, say like email configurations. You can do all of that with Text Expander for Teams. So if you're on a team, Text Expander can change your life, leaving more time for what you do best, your job, right? So you don't have to think about a lot of this stuff. It's going to save you time, and that ultimately saves you money. And for larger teams, Text Expander supports single sign-on and also grouping accounts to make onboarding a breeze. You can visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more about Text Expander for Teams, and a huge thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. Well, guess what? Apple announced its third quarter 2018 earnings here at the end of the month, and maybe not a surprise, things went really well for Apple. They actually set a record for the best June quarter ever. They had quarterly revenue of $53.3 billion. That's an increase of 17% from the same quarter a year ago. As far as why they did so well, Tim Cook said on the call that Apple's iPhone sales continued to be strong. They had great growth in services and also wearables, meaning those Apple Watches were a big key to the success for the quarter. In fact, iPhone sales were up slightly from the same quarter a year ago. Yeah, iPhone sales actually up a little bit from 41 million units to 41.3 million units this year. So up just slightly. You might argue that they were flat, but at least that wasn't a decline in unit sales. Services also continues to be the big area of revenue growth, or a big area of revenue growth for Apple, up 31% year over year. It generated $9.55 billion in revenue. That's up from $9.2 billion last year, and it continues to be Apple's second largest revenue generator behind the iPhone. Like 18% of Apple's revenue is coming now from services, and that is trumping even the Mac, which is running, I think, around 10% of all Apple's revenue at this point. Now, of course, Apple doesn't break out specific Apple Watch sales. It's part of their other category. Their other products' revenue actually rose 37% in the third quarter of 2018, up to $3.7 billion from $2.7 billion a year ago. And while they don't break that stuff out, Apple did tell the Financial Times that wearables revenue is up 60% year over year. And I have to imagine a big part of that is Apple Watch. Maybe some of that is the AirPods a little bit. Apple did comment that they were selling AirPods as fast as they could possibly make them. Moving back to the Apple Watch stuff, though, doing a little math on that data, the Financial Times thinks that yearly wearables revenue now exceeds about $10 billion for Apple. So Apple Watch doing very, very well. And as a matter of fact, for the second quarter, Canalysis did a little estimating, and they believe the LTE Apple Watch 3 has actually helped Apple increase sales 30%, with Apple selling an estimated 3.5 million units in the second quarter. That would increase their market share in the smartwatch category to 43%, up from 34%. So again, Apple Watch doing very well, and Tim did cite that as one of the big revenue generators for this third quarter. Moving on to iPad sales, they were also up just a hair, a tiny, tiny fraction of an amount. Apple said they sold 11.5 million iPads versus 11.4 million iPads in the same quarter a year ago. Now, Mac sales, unfortunately, those were the downer for the day. Apple said they sold just 3.7 million units in the third quarter of 2018. That's versus 4.3 million units in the third quarter of 2017. So Mac sales down quite a bit in terms of unit numbers, but really that's not surprising given the lack of new Mac models. Yes, we did get that new MacBook Pro update, which is awesome, and I expect Apple to sell a lot of those, but it was really too late in the quarter to have any impact on these numbers. A few other items of note from this earnings call. 1 billion Apple Pay transactions in this fiscal year. That is triple year-over-year growth, according to Apple. As a matter of fact, Jupiter Research recently estimated that Apple Pay accounts for about half of mobile wallets that are in use, 225 million users out of a total of 450 million users on all platforms. So Apple Pay, by far the most popular digital wallet payment platform, mobile payments platform, that is good news for Apple. I am a huge fan of Apple Pay. I love using it whenever I can. I I'm always hoping I can use it more places. Another thing Apple mentioned it during this earnings results call is finally CVS is going to allow Apple Pay. If you remember way back when, they disabled it in favor of the now failed Currency payments platform. So they're going to be opening that up, and Apple continues to work to expand and grow Apple Pay. And sounds like it's paying off for them. And then lastly, another thing paying off in this quarter, we mentioned services. Part of that is Apple Music. 50 million Apple Music listeners now, they say, across both paid subscriptions and free trials. And as a matter of fact, revenues on Apple Music grew 50% over this past quarter. So Apple continuing to expand rapidly on Apple Music, and that's a significant contributor to their services revenue. And I have to imagine, once they launch this video service sometime in 2019, that is going to be another leapfrog for services. And I look forward to seeing that happen. But overall, fabulous quarter for Apple, third quarter of 2018. Much better than I thought they were going to do, although they did note it was in some of the numbers a little bit lower than what Wall Street was expecting. So we'll have to see and watch what this does to the stock price. But I think, you know, with these kind of numbers, Apple's going to be just fine. As we get closer to the fall, we are getting more and more details about this year's iPhone lineup. It's starting to solidify at this point. We're at that magic place where we're a few months from the announcement, and that means we're getting stronger leaks and indications coming out of the supply chain. Yes, Tim Cook says don't trust the supply chain, but as we get closer to the actual announcement launch date, it starts to become a little bit more believable. And this time around, this week, Apple leaker Benjamin Geskin, who's been pretty accurate with a lot of his leaks in the past, he posted some images of dummy units of the new iPhones to his Twitter account, and it seemingly confirms the three sizes that we've already been talking about, three sizes, three models. The two OLED models, 5.8 inch replacing the current iPhone X, and a new larger 6.5 inch iPhone X model, and then the lower cost, really mid-range priced 6.1 inch LCD model. It does show the 6.5 inch version with a two lens camera, not a three lens camera. There had been some rumors out there that there may be a third lens added in there, although it was debatable. A lot of the images, it just looked like it was the LED flash, which sits in the middle, that a lot of people were trying to call the third lens. So expect that to be a two-lens camera system, just like in the 5.8 inch model. And then a few more details on the 6.1 inch model. It's believed that it will have an aluminum frame instead of a steel frame. And these are all things to kind of reduce the cost, the production cost, so that it can be that lower priced model. So steel, aluminum frame instead of steel. We've already heard the rumors that it may not have 3D touch on the display. Also, it will have just a single lens camera, and it may be the only model that will come in colors. So I don't know if that means it's meant to replace the iPhone SE. Something that was noted in the quarterly results call was that the iPhone SE isn't quite selling as well as Apple would like anymore, and I have a feeling that's because it's getting a little long in the tooth. It's very popular model, but it's been around for a while and hasn't been updated in a while. And it should be priced around $600, according to some reports. There's some other reports that say $700 to $800 for the lower cost model. That seems a little bit too high for me, especially since the 5.8 inch iPhone X replacement is expected to start at around $899. And the Plus model is expected to start around $999. So I think it's going to be a little more toward that $600 range. Now, as far as when we expect to see them, we expect to get some sort of announcement in September, and probably a launch Release date in October. That's historically how Apple has been rolling them out. But that 6.1 inch model might be the iPhone X of 2018, because it's sounding like there could be a shipping delay on that model. Katie Huberty of Morgan Stanley mentioned that her sources are citing issues with the production of the new backlight system that is the key to producing that reduced bezel design in an LCD display. It's supposedly a display being produced by Japan Display, and it's being called a full active screen, and that apparently is what allows them to reduce that bezel size. Ming-Chi Kuo had also recently talked about similar rumors about a delay on the LCD model, so we're hearing now that it might not ship until November. If you remember, this year, last year in 2017, Apple released the iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus models first in October, and we didn't get the iPhone X shipping until later in December. So kind of flopping things around maybe this year. And on that display, there's a little bit of mixed signals, because LG is also expected to be supplying about 20 million displays, 20 million of the 6.1 inch LCD model displays, and they were going to produce some of the OLED screens, but have reportedly run into some production issues and aren't going to be able to provide as many as Apple would need. So production is going to mostly fall on Samsung once again for the OLED panels for the 5.8 and 6.5 inch models. And speaking of that 6.5 inch model, there is now additional evidence to a rumor we have been hearing that the larger version of the iPhone X might be the first to feature dual SIM support, which is something that's very important for a lot of international markets and also travelers who travel internationally. So you could have two SIM cards in there, two different carriers on two different continents, and not have to be constantly swapping SIMs. New information was found in the latest iOS 12 Beta 5 release. There are references to a component of the system responsible for generating diagnostic reports that includes references to a, quote, second SIM status and also a second SIM tray status. And there's also another component reference to a dual SIM device. So it's looking like that may become a reality, and something that a lot of people have been hoping Apple would produce for a while. There's a number of Android devices that offer dual SIM support. So this would be the first iPhone model, should it happen, to have that. And then also in iOS 12 and the Xcode simulator, it's seeming to suggest that this iPhone X Plus model will also have the ability to operate in landscape mode, which makes sense considering, I believe, the iPhone 8 Plus and the Plus models have had that capability for a while, and this would be the iPhone X version of that Plus size. So that's not too surprising to me, but we are now seeing evidence that that will happen. And then Qualcomm CFO George Davis this week told investors that Apple will use a competitor's chips in all of its 2018 iPhones. Now, this was something that we thought might happen, that Apple would be moving away from Qualcomm LTE modem chips because they've had kind of a rough relationship with Qualcomm. As a matter of fact, they've been trading lawsuits back and forth for a few years. Apple did move to using a number of Intel's cellular modem chips in their devices with the release of the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and the iPhone 10. But this would mark the first kind of confirmation that Apple is wholly moving away from Qualcomm's cellular modem chips. He didn't mention specifically who would be providing those to Apple. The assumption is that it would be Intel in this year's lineup, although we also have heard of another company called MediaTek that may produce some LTE modems for Apple this year. And this is despite the rumors we had heard previously that Intel would provide about 70% of the modem chips, with Qualcomm kind of covering the balance. This coming straight from the CFO at Qualcomm seems to confirm that Apple is not buying modem chips for any 2018 models from them this year. So that's kind of the latest on iPhone models. We also have a little report on what's happening with maybe the next generation of iPad Pros. This is coming from Macatakara. They're saying it's going to lose the headphone jack this year. Again, I don't think a big shocker to anyone, but they're saying that Apple will not include an adapter with the iPad Pros. Again, something that I personally don't find too surprising, but maybe frustrating for some people. And it's also believed that Apple wants to, again, reduce the bezels and, more importantly, reduce the physical size of this year's iPad Pros while still maintaining the 10.5-inch and the 12.9-inch display sizes. So they're going to get physically smaller, but have the same displays and same display real estate. And they're going to achieve that, it's expected, by taking on a lot of the cues from the iPhone X. So reduced bezels, no home button. There will be a notch and a true depth camera system, because, of course, without a home button, no Touch ID. So they're going to go with Face ID. Unfortunately, this Macatakara report claims that there's going to be no support for Face ID in landscape mode on the iPad, which that is completely baffling to me. I can't imagine Apple doing that. So that adds an air of less credibility to this rumor, because so many people use their iPads, especially the iPad Pros, the larger ones, in landscape mode. That's actually my preferred method for using it, for watching movies, for typing out notes, for browsing, reading emails. I think about the only thing I use my iPad in portrait mode for is like reading books or reading longer form PDFs or something like that. So I have to imagine Apple is going to allow Face ID to work in landscape mode. But according to this report, no. They're also claiming, oddly, that Apple will move the smart connector for the Apple Smart Keyboard to the short side of the iPad, just behind or near the Lightning connector. They don't talk about how the new smart keyboard is going to work and connect if it's over there, but presumably you'd have to have a new smart keyboard. Now, initially I thought, well, that stinks, because that means you got to buy a new smart keyboard. But because of the size change, that was likely going to happen anyway, so that wouldn't be that big a deal. But it just seems odd to move the smart connector to that side, although there was also a CAD image leaked this week from OnLeaks that seems to corroborate that rumor. It's odd. We've heard it from a couple sources now. Personally, I don't think it's going to happen. I think the smart connector is going to stay right where it was, and the smart keyboard is going to function the same, but who knows? I could be wrong. What do you think? Does it seem weird that Apple wouldn't have the Face ID work in landscape and they would move the smart connector? It seems to presume that they want you to use your iPad in portrait mode, and I don't think that's all that functional, to be honest. I think iPad is a device that demands to be used in mostly landscape mode, but I guess we'll find out in a couple months when Apple's expected to announce new iPad Pros. Loop Ventures ran some smartphone AR digital assistant testing, comparing Siri, Google Assistant, Alexa, and Cortana on smartphones, asking them 800 questions each, the same questions, and got some surprising results. The testing covered questions across five key areas. They identified local, which would be asking it about things like where's the nearest coffee shop, commerce, where or can you order me more paper towels, navigation, so how do I get to a certain place, also information, are the Twins playing tonight, music information, that sort of stuff, and command kinds of questions, things like setting reminders, adding things to your calendar, those sorts of things. And the assistants were then evaluated based on two different metrics. Did it understand the question that was being asked? And then secondly, did it handle the question correctly and deliver the correct response? And I think it's key to note that what they were testing here is digital assistants on smartphones. They were not testing smart speakers like the Echo or the HomePod. And surprising, Siri actually did very, very well, coming in just behind Google Assistant, but ahead of Alexa and Cortana. And I say very well because I often hear from people who claim Alexa is so much better than Siri. Siri actually understood 99% of the queries that it was asked, which is excellent, and was able to answer correctly and handle 78.5% of those requests. They noted that Siri was significantly improved from the last time they ran this testing back in April of 2017, when Siri was only able to correctly answer about 66% of the questions. Now, Google Assistant did beat out Siri in every category except the command category. Remember, that's handling tasks for doing things like controlling your phone, controlling your smart home systems, listening to music, all those basic things, setting reminders, calendar stuff, contact information, those sorts of tasks. Siri actually scored 90% versus Google Assistant, which came in second place, correctly handling about 78% of those requests. So the researchers were very impressed with Siri's ability to be slightly more helpful and versatile, especially when responding to more flexible language, kind of more natural language. And I think that's a testament to Apple really working on their AI and their machine learning and building that in and continuing to improve Siri. And I don't know about you, but me personally, over the past six months, past year, I've found Siri to be more and more accurate, more and more reliable in many scenarios where it wasn't working quite as well in the past. And so I think this data sort of backs that up. They also mentioned being impressed with the speed at which this technology is advancing, not just for Siri, but for all of the assistants that they're testing. And I think ultimately that's good for us as users. You know, being able to use voice assistants and voice technology is really handy in a lot of scenarios. And I'm finding myself personally using it more and more. And the more accurate and the better it gets at handling those responses, I think means the more people will be willing to use it more frequently. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. I mean, hey, controlling your computer with your voice, this is something we've wanted since, you know, Star Trek came out in the 70s, probably even through sci-fi movies before that. But, you know, the big one I remember from my childhood was Star Trek, right? You want to be able to just talk to the ship's computer and have it do things. And we're getting really, really close, I think, to that reality. Well, those MacBook Pros, those new MacBook Pro, the 2018 ones, they are awesome screaming machines. You can get them configured so they are just workhorse beasts. But unfortunately, it looks like there's another issue. You remember that Apple had the issue where they were being accused of throttling those machines. An update came out last week that addressed that. It was actually a software bug, so that was handled. Looking like now, at least for some owners, there are reports of another potential issue, this time related to the T2 security chip that's in there. A small number of users are reporting that they're seeing kernel panics on their new machines. This was something that also apparently impacted some iMac Pro users and seems to be related to the T2 chip. The common thread here seems to be that the kernel panics are noting an issue with Bridge OS. And if you don't know what Bridge OS is that's the small embedded operating system that's used to drive the new T2 security chip that is found right now only in the 2018 MacBook Pros and the iMac Pro. So the T2 has its own embedded operating system. It handles things like the secure boot, the encrypted storage, being able to respond to "Hey Lady" commands. Apple is reportedly already aware of this issue. They're looking into what the potential cause is and trying to get a fix. In the meantime, there does seem to be a variety of possible workarounds being thrown around online on places like Reddit and Stack Exchange that might help you avoid the issues. So if you do have a new 2018 MacBook Pro and you're experiencing kernel panics, there's a few different things you can try. They say don't daisy chain devices off of the Thunderbolt chain. Also, don't use a Thunderbolt 3 to Thunderbolt 2 adapter. Turning off PowerNap might help. Turning off Secure Boot might help, although that does reduce your security, so I'm not sure I would really want to do that. They say don't unlock the device with an Apple Watch, remove any third-party kernel extensions, or turn off every power management option. So that's kind of the mojo, the rubber chicken kind of things that you could try. This is people testing through trial and error. It does appear to me in reading all of this that this might be some sort of software conflict, some obscure software conflict. And again, it's affecting a small number of people. And that seems to be confirmed by Apple's official suggestion for dealing with this. And I think this information comes out of troubleshooting with the iMac Pro models. But they're saying wipe and reload the Mac operating system from scratch. This reportedly fixes most systems, again, suggesting that this is some sort of software conflict, you know, where if you've been just doing over-the-top upgrades, there's some old piece of software or old remnant of some system that might be conflicting with the new system and the T2 chip. So that's one recommendation from Apple. They also say disable File Vault and disable PowerNap. And that apparently is the fix that worked for most iMac Pro owners. So you might try that one first, disabling PowerNap. And if then that doesn't work, wipe and reload the Mac operating system from scratch. But again, hopefully this is something that Apple can fix in software. It seems like it is, and there should be a patch out soon because they are working on it. Last thing I have for you in the news this week is something that makes me really happy. I can't tell you how happy this potential news makes me. And it's that Apple might be working on a Time Bandits series. Now, if you don't know what Time Bandits is, it is a movie by Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame. It is a movie that I loved from my childhood, and there are now reports that Apple is working to try and do a deal to adapt the film content into a television series for its new video service. For those of you who don't know what Time Bandits is, it's basically this comedy adventure movie about a band of dwarves who have stolen a time map and are running around through time, trying to evade or get away from their former boss who they stole this map from, the Supreme Being, and they're traveling through time stealing valuables to make money. That's the bandits part of Time Bandits. And in the film, they run across an imaginative 11-year-old boy named Kevin who kind of gets sucked in with them into their adventures. And it's just a really funny, fun movie. Absolutely love it. I think it could make a great fun TV series, and I hope this is something that Apple is able to sign on. Now, the new TV series is supposedly going to be a co-production between Anonymous Content, Paramount Television, and Media Rights Capital. Gilliam will serve as an executive producer, but unfortunately is not going to be writing, at least according to the reports. They don't say who the writer would be. Again, this is just preliminary talks, but hopefully Apple is able to do a deal on this because I think it could be great. And I just get more and more excited, as you know, about Apple's original content. I was already excited about Amazing Stories being something that Apple is going to reboot. And this is just more icing on the cake. I can't wait for this video service. They can just take my money now because I'm going to be subscribing right away, however they decide to sell it. And that's another big question is we don't know if they're going to roll this in with Apple Music and kind of have one big subscription service. There are some rumors that they are going to kind of roll it out like an Amazon Prime kind of service where you would get iCloud, Apple Music, and the video service kind of all in one package. And then they would also give you options to piece it out and buy individual pieces if you don't want all of it. But for me, I already subscribe to iCloud. I already subscribe to Apple Music. So having it all in one seems like the best deal for me. And I'm hoping that's the route they go. But we won't know about that till probably sometime in 2019. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment, thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Jamf Now. This episode is being brought to you by Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. It's easy to keep track of your own Mac, iPad, or iPhone, but what about other Apple devices at work? As a business grows, you gain new digital inventory, you gain more Macs and iPads and iPhones. That makes it exponentially harder to manage everyone's Apple devices. And this is especially true if you work in a remote office environment. If you have remote employees, work-at-home employees, you got to track that stuff too. And with Jamf Now, you can check your digital inventory, you can distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, you can deploy apps, you can protect your company data, and even lock or wipe devices as needed from anywhere. Jamf Now manages your devices so you can focus on your business instead. No IT experience needed. If you run any kind of operation where you're dealing with multiple devices, a multi-device management solution is a must, so you really should take a moment and check out Jamf Now. They make it super easy to get started because you can manage up to 3 devices for free, completely free, so you could try it out. And Jamf Now is specifically designed for teams and small businesses, and they make it really easy to get going. MacCast listeners, you can start securing your business today, setting up your first 3 devices for free, and that is forever. And you can add more devices for just $2 per month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/MacCast. That's jamf.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Jamf for their support of the MacCast. All right, in our ongoing discussions about subscription pricing and subscription-based apps, Joe wrote in to add some of his thoughts and perspective to the conversation because he wanted to bring up something that we really hadn't kind of covered yet or discussed yet. And Joe is a developer, so this is kind of close to his heart. You know, it's something that he has to think about on a daily basis. And his opinion was that, you know, subscriptions, developers moving to the subscription model, subscription pricing model, is really a result, he feels, of Apple forcing developers' hands and not allowing options for paid upgrades in their app stores. This is an argument that we've heard for a long time now, and it's still a valid argument. Apple does not allow paid upgrades, so developers have had to come up with other models to kind of get sustaining revenue. The theory is that subscriptions are the only way for really the only way left for developers to reasonably get a sustainable recurring revenue from upgraders to their apps, right? If you're not able to offer a paid upgrade, how do you get people to continue to pay money as you as a developer spend time and effort to develop new features and functionality? You're not just going to keep giving away free updates. You need a way to be able to gain that recurring revenue. You know, others have tried the new paid version thing. That's another option. But as anyone knows, that makes discovery and finding out about that new version hard. I've run into this problem. I've gone like 3 months and not known that like a new version of Twitterific was out or Tweetbot, right? And suddenly, hey, version 3 has been out. It's been out for, you know, 3 months and I didn't know because I missed it, and version 2 is still working and you have to buy the new version. So that's not ideal. It makes really marketing hard for the developer, and it can just anger customers. I get really frustrated when I find out I missed a new version. And so subscriptions is kind of that thing, as Joe points out, that developers are just forced to turn to, and then they take a lot of flack from their customers who don't, you know, from some of their customers who don't like subscription models and get angry that this is the direction they've chose to move in. And again, I mentioned Joe is a small developer. He had an app in the App Store. It was released 9 years ago. And he pointed out, you know, without a paid upgrade option, it really seems like Apple is telling developers, well, you just gotta, you know, offer free updates for forever. And of course, that's not a sustainable model. And Joe, with his app, he tried the in-app purchase thing. That is another thing that often developers will turn to, offering additional content for a price. But for him, that didn't click with the users of his app. It really didn't generate a sustainable revenue. So eventually he settled on making the app free. He kind of went with a freemium model with a $2, what amounts to a $2 per year in-app purchase for yearly updates of data that his app needs to kind of remain fresh. So every year there's kind of new data that needs to feed into it, and he does a $2, I think, in-app purchase. I apologize, Joe, if I'm getting this wrong, but it's a $2 in-app purchase to get that year's data. So not technically a subscription, but kind of working like a opt-in subscription, let's say, or a you know, you have to pay to re-up every year kind of subscription where it's not auto-renew. But basically the same exact concept. And he said, you know, I feel like really like Apple has left me with no options and forced me into this. And so we're kind of pointing the blame in the wrong place. It's not developers that are doing this. It's Apple that is doing this. And my main reply to Joe was, yes, you know, this has been going on and been a complaint about the App Store and the app pricing model for years. And you know, what I'm trying to point out is at this point, Apple isn't going to change it. If they haven't changed it after 10 years of doing this and 10 years of developers begging for it and asking for it and consumers asking for it, I don't think it's going to happen. So that may not be what developers want to hear. It may not be what customers want to hear, but that's the reality that we're living in. And that's sort of where I was coming to with all of this, is that I'm starting to accept that we're going to have various pricing models for various apps, and developers are going to have to figure out what works for them. And if we want to support those developers as customers, as buyers of the software, then we have to accept and be willing to buy into those various models. And we don't have to buy into the subscription model for everything. There are choices out there. We can choose where we want to spend our dollars. And this is the ecosystem that we have now. So if you want to develop apps, if you want to buy apps, you've kind of got to buy into this new world order that exists for buying apps. I think in the past I called it the new app order, and I didn't like it. I really didn't like it at first, but I think developers are figuring it out. They're figuring out where certain models work and where they don't. And for me, in general, for most of the software that I use, it's working out. And I have a mix of things that I use. I have some stuff that I subscribe to, and it's the subscription model. I have stuff that I just purchase, and I have stuff that is freemium-based stuff. So I have a mix and match, and, you know, Joe, you found a way within the rules, and you mentioned in your email you think it seems to be working for you now. It may not be the thing that you wanted. I totally get that it was difficult to implement and you wish you had more options, but you don't. But you found a way to get that recurring revenue for your app, and hopefully enough revenue that means you'll want to continue to develop it and update it for your customers. And, you know, we as customers, we have had to make the same decisions about software regardless of the model since the very beginning. You know, you look at a piece of software, you look at the cost, the total cost of ownership, however you pay for that, whether it's a subscription, a paid for update, whatever it might be, and then you assess a value to that. You say, is the value that I'm paying worth what I'm getting out of it? And if not, then you go find something else. And so all I've been trying to say with all of this, I know this has been going on for a long time, but I think it's a really important discussion for us to have. And it seems like something that a lot of you in the community are thinking about, because I'm getting a lot of responses on this. But all I've been saying is that, at least for me personally, I'm done kind of ranting and raving and raging against the system. I'm tired of it. I'm also tired of hearing people vilify developers for choosing one model or another. You know, it's really a business decision that they have to make within this ecosystem that, again, Joe, I totally agree, has been forced upon them in certain ways. You know, I think there are ways around it, but they're a little bit more difficult. But if you buy into the ecosystem, if you as a developer say, I want to develop for the Mac App Store, I want to develop for the iOS App Store because there's all these great advantages to it, and I think there are a lot of advantages, I'm willing to accept this sort of sandbox and these restrictions that I have to play in, and I'm going to figure it out. And I think developers are figuring it out, and I think consumers are figuring it out, and I think it's all okay. I think that's the point. But again, at the end of the day, the equation is the same, whatever the model. Paid upgrade, free within app purchases, subscriptions. Does the app provide a value to you for the price that you have to pay? Is it worth it? And if the answer is yes, buy it and enjoy it. Don't worry so much about how you're paying for it, or, you know, you need to look at the total cost of ownership. And if that value is there, then great. If the answer is no, move on and find the app that does it. It really, I think, is that simple. And that's just the resolution that I've come to. And you don't have to come to the same resolution. I get it if you're the type of person that's like, no, this is ridiculous. I'm never going to pay an in-app subscription. I think it's extortion. I think, you know, you have the right to that opinion. And luckily, though, we live in this world where there is a big, healthy app ecosystem. And there's a lot of great developers in this community creating great apps and great alternatives. And you can find the app and the pricing model that suits you. And that's, again, my ultimate point. So thanks to everybody who has been chiming in on this. I think we're going to wrap this one up. Let's just close this out. I think this is the last episode where we need to talk about subscription app pricing. We can continue to have those conversations in emails. If you want to email me, again, feel free. I always love getting email from you. I'd love to continue the conversation. But I think we're kind of done with it for here on the MacCast for a while, at least in audio form. Are you thinking about one of those new 2018 MacBook Pros? Boy, I can tell you I am. The reviews on those things are coming out really, really good. They're screaming machines. You can get them configured like beasts. They are just amazing. I've heard from a few of you in our community who have received yours already, and it's been nothing but positive. You say you're loving them. If I had the cash, I'd probably plunk down on one right now, but unfortunately I don't. But John did, and he picked one up, but he discovered something that was a little bit frustrating for him, and he wanted to share some information with us. So something you might want to hear about if you're considering one of those new 2018 MacBook Pros. So here's John.
Hi, Adam. This is John from beautiful Palos Verdes, California. I jumped on the new 2018 MacBook Pro the day it came out, because I'm a heavy user and the 16 gigabits of RAM in my 2016 model was constantly overstressed and causing slowdowns and freezes. This new machine goes up to 32 and it's greatly appreciated. The new keyboard is quieter, something that should help save my marriage since I often get up early while traveling and the clatter of keys was very unpopular with my wife. I wanted to point out one important change that could cause frustration to anyone who occasionally boots from an external drive. For instance, I make super duper clones every night and occasionally will boot from them if something goes wrong with my internal drive. I also have a flash drive with Disk Warrior to boot from in emergencies. Beginning with this 2018 MacBook Pro, you can no longer boot from an external drive unless you go through an inconvenient process of changing the settings on the recovery partition. First, you have to reboot holding Command-R to boot to the built-in Mac recovery partition. Once there, from the menu item along the top, you'll need to select Startup Security Utility. It's buried in that menu. Then you'll need to authenticate with your password. Finally, you'll have to change security from high to none, and then click Allow Booting from Hard Drives from the selection of two options at the bottom, then restart. While I understand that Apple's trying to protect us, I see no value in this change or these precautions. My hard drive's protected with FileVault, so even if someone boots my Mac from an external drive, they cannot access my data. I've been an avid listener to the MacCast since the first year and appreciate all that you do, Adam. Keep up the great work. Thanks.
Hey, John. Thank you for pointing that out. I'm sure that's going to be very helpful to a number of people who are getting new MacBook Pros, because you're right. I mean, if you're doing clone backups, which a lot of us do, having that convenience of being able to boot from a clone backup is important. On the security side of things, though, I can kind of maybe shed some light on why this is a good protection, even if you are using FileVault, because potentially, if someone can boot from an external volume, they can start sort of banging away at your Mac, at your operating system. So shutting that down is just another layer of security. And depending upon how your system passwords are and things like that, you know, some people don't use really secure passwords. I'm sure that you do, but it's a common thing. So a lot of times, you know, the security things that get put in place are there for people who maybe think less about security than maybe someone like yourself or myself does, or anybody probably who listens to the MacCast. And then Apple has settings and controls like this for us more advanced users. You can go in when you know what you're doing and you know that you have other protections in place, and you can disable sort of the dummy settings, right? This is the let's set it as secure as possible for everyone, and then people who really know about security and know these things can tweak it. You know, the pro users can tweak it. And I think that's the right approach to take, right? It's going to keep everybody more secure. So to get into a little more detail about what John is talking about here and just give you more information, is the feature that he's mentioning, again, is only something that exists on Macs that have the T2 security chip, and that would be the iMac Pro and the 2018 MacBook Pro. And this is the chip. It basically, the thing we were talking about earlier, it has its own little operating system. It actually is embedded and runs before any of the operating system stuff loads, and it handles some of the pre-security stuff. So that would include things like the boot process and booting from external drives. And specifically, the thing that is controlling this, as John mentioned in his voicemail, is something called Startup Security Utility. And inside that, there's actually really two main settings. There's the secure boot setting and the external boot setting. And you can set these things separate. I think, John, you mentioned in there that you needed to disable the secure boot and the external boot. I think you should be able to just change the external boot, but you might know more about it. Maybe you already checked with somebody like Carbon Copy Cloner developers or a super duper developer and found out differently. But secure boot really should only control whether or not you have an authorized, legitimate, trusted operating system. So Apple says basically that feature is designed to make sure that your Mac always starts up from a legitimate, trusted Mac operating system, so an operating system that's signed, or a Microsoft Windows operating system. So it may depend upon which version of the OS you have on your cloned drive or your bootable USB stick. If it's a current signed, like if you've got High Sierra on there, I would imagine it would just boot even with the highest setting for the secure boot options, you know, the full security, which is the default. But you're right, you can go in and change that. You can set it to medium, which means it's only going to look for a signed operating system, anything that Apple has signed, or you can turn it off completely. Now, the external boot option, that's the option that's going to control whether or not you can boot from external sources like a USB stick or an external USB drive. And just like you said in that voicemail, to enable this, you have to boot into the recovery partition, or to change the settings for it or access it, you need to boot into the recovery partition on your Mac. So hold down Command R at boot up. Once you're in there, you're going to go under the utilities menu and launch the startup security utility from that menu bar. You're going to be asked to authenticate with your Mac password, and then you'll also need to enter the information for your administrator account. So administrator account and password, you have to kind of level up the permissions. And then once in there, you'll see the options for the secure boot options and for the external boot settings, and you can change the external boot setting to allow boot from external media. And once you've changed that, I think, as near as I can tell from reading this documentation, you only have to change it the one time. And then once it's set to that setting, it will remain there until you change it again. So it's really just kind of a one-time operation. I don't see that as being all that inconvenient. And again, I think it's Apple erring on the side of, let's protect everyone at a real high secure level and then let the knowledgeable users override those settings. And for me, that sounds like the right approach. But thanks for pointing that out, because again, I think there's going to be a lot of people picking up those new 2018 MacBook Pros, and they might not realize that's there, or an iMac Pro. If you have an iMac Pro, again, these settings are the same, and you may or may not have been aware of that. Something that we've covered on the MacCast in the past is encrypted disk images. I have mentioned this before, that I use Apple's disk utility to create an encrypted HFS Plus disk image, which is basically like a little hard drive storage container inside another drive, and I use that for storing sensitive information. For example, I use an application called Paperless, where I scan in all my bills and my credit card statements and my tax forms and all that stuff into a system, into a piece of software from the folks at Mariner Software. And I manage all my data there. And all that data goes into kind of a library file, very similar to like your Photos library or your iTunes library. And that is information that I don't want getting out. I want that encrypted. I want it safe and secure. And even though I use File Vault and I encrypt my entire internal disk, I want an additional layer of protection. So I've set up this encrypted disk image that sits on one of my external hard drives. And if I want to add stuff into Paperless, I have to mount that disk image. I have to enter my password to decrypt that. And then I can add additional documents and information to that data library. I also just have some folders on there to also store other sensitive documents. Again, PDFs of my tax forms and stuff like that are in there, and it keeps it all secure. And I do, like I said, use File Vault on both my main drive and my Time Machine drives, although I don't encrypt other external storage volumes, and that's where that encrypted disk images. So I kind of selectively choose certain bits of information that on those external drives I want to make sure are stored in an encrypted format. And we've covered this all in the past. If you go into Disk Utilities, so into your Applications folder, into Utilities, and launch Disk Utility, you can find the options for creating one of these encrypted disk images. And they're really handy, again, for storing that kind of sensitive information. And Alex wrote in, though, because he had a couple questions in light of Apple's new file system. So I mentioned I do all of this with HFS Plus. We now have Apple file system, APFS, and that actually handles encryption differently and supposedly better. And so he was asking, you know, is that maybe a better format for doing that? And then taking that even further, he says, you know, I actually use Macs and PCs and other platforms, and so might it be better if there was a common format, something like XFAT, that I could use on a Windows machine and still have encryption? So I could have an encrypted disk, like an external drive or a USB stick, and I could put stuff on there and I could take it back and forth between Windows and my Mac. And so I thought we'd kind of address some of that. And we'll start with just the encryption side of things. APFS encryption versus HFS Plus encryption. So encryption was something that was not from the ground up built into the HFS Plus file system. And so when Apple wanted to set up File Vault and File Vault 2 and add encryption to that file system, the way they did it was they developed core storage technology. And you don't need to know much about this other than to understand that what it does is it creates kind of this wrapper around the file system. It encrypts your volume data at a block level. And when you unlock a volume from core storage, so it basically creates this image, it manages it with core storage. And when you unlock one of those volumes inside core storage, what it does is it creates this new logical device, something that looks like a mounted hard drive or volume, but it's really just this container and it's unencrypted all at once. So you end up with the entire contents of that HFS file system being unencrypted. And this includes unallocated space. It's just one big continuous chunk of data. That's that encrypted disk image that I was talking about. So when you create an encrypted disk image, you kind of have to say, okay, this is the maximum size I want this thing to be. So like I created a 500 megabyte one that I put my stuff onto, and it doesn't use up 500 megabytes of disk space. It will grow over time, but the biggest that it can get is that 500 megabytes. So it's this like allocated thing. And when I mount that, when I enter that password, it basically decrypts that whole thing, and that thing sits there and is available to be read and written to. And APFS was created differently. It was actually created from the ground up with encryption in mind. They call it a first-class citizen. You know, encryption is a first-class citizen of the APFS Apple file system. And it doesn't use an additional layer like core storage. So with APFS, if you have an APFS formatted volume, when you turn on something like File Vault 2, it doesn't move everything over into this container that's managed by something different like core storage. It just enables the encryption that's built into the file system. And this is more secure because it doesn't have that whole unencrypted block of the entire file system sitting there unencrypted once you boot your operating system and you're working with it. It can actually manage the encryption kind of on the fly within the file system more smartly. And both systems actually use the same type of encryption. It's XTS AES 128-bit ciphers, but APFS volumes are also able to use randomly generated secondary encryption keys. And so they are actually also better at withstanding cryptographic attacks. So they're more robust, they're more secure. So yes, APFS is a better ground up file system for having encrypted volumes and dealing with encryption. And so if you are on a modern Mac with an SSD and you have an APFS formatted volume, it's probably a pretty good idea to turn on and use FileVault. So it's going to, because it's going to better protect your data, it's going to do it very efficiently, and it's going to do it in a very, very smart way. The problem, of course, with that is that it's not cross-platform. Apple File System is exclusive, as the name implies, to the Mac operating system, Mac and iOS operating systems. They actually both use APFS now. So what if you want to, the second part of Alex's question, what if you want to use external volumes like USB sticks, but you want to go cross-platform? APFS is not going to help with that. You can't format the drive in that format and enable encryption and take it over to a Windows machine and access those encrypted files or that data. And so I did a little research on this because I didn't really know what the options were. And really the one that kept coming up was something that used to be called TrueCrypt, but is now called VeraCrypt. And it basically allows you to insert a USB stick or an external volume, launch the VeraCrypt app, and create a cross-platform disk image, sort of just like the same kind of disk image I described the creating with Disk Utility and HFS Plus. And so you can download the software. It's open source. It's free. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It is, I will tell you, the interface is a little bit technical and a little bit daunting. So if you're timid about that stuff, just be prepared. But it's not that difficult. It's not that tricky. I'll walk you through the process. Basically, you insert, let's just do an example for a USB stick. So say you have a USB stick, you want to make it cross-platform and you want it to be encrypted with VeraCrypt. You put in your USB stick. You're going to want to probably open your Disk Utility first and format that as a cross-platform format. I would pick either the FAT format or the XFAT format. That'll allow you to read it and write it both on your Mac and on your Windows machine. So format it that way. And then you'll launch VeraCrypt, and in the VeraCrypt interface, you're going to click on the Create Volume button. And that's going to open up this kind of wizard, and it's going to give you some options. On the first screen, you're going to choose that you want to create an encrypted file container and click Next. Then you're going to choose the standard VeraCrypt volume option. That's the kind of container that you want to create. You're going to click Next. Then for the location of the, you need to select the location of the container. So you're going to choose the USB stick. You're going to enter the name for the file. That's going to be the container. And you're going to click Next. And then it will ask you to choose your encryption. The defaults should be fine here. AES is the encryption type, and the hashing algorithm. Again, if you don't know what these terms mean, you don't need to worry about it too much. Just pick the defaults. The hash algorithm is going to be SHA-512. So choose that, click Next. And then you need to select your volume size. Just like I mentioned earlier with the HFS Plus encrypted disk images, you've got to kind of predefine the volume size. And you can do it by megabytes or gigabytes. The one thing that I ran into with the VeraCrypt software that was a little bit frustrating was it seemed like I could only pick whole numbers. So I couldn't say like 6.7 gigabytes, which was the total available space that I had on my formatted USB stick. I could only say six, and I could say seven, but obviously that is larger than the available disk space. And if you try and do that, it's going to fail to create the encrypted disk image. So you have to pick a size that's smaller slightly smaller than the total available disk space that you have, and you apparently can only do it in whole numbers. I don't know if that's a bug or not. It felt like a bug to me in the software, but pick that and then click next. And then it will ask you to choose and confirm a password. That's going to be the password that you're going to need to enter every time you want to mount that encrypted volume and read or write files to it. So pick a really good, strong password. Maybe put it in an application like 1Password, and you need to remember it, because if you forget it, you're not going to be able to get at your data. So it's very important that you don't forget that password. So choose the password, click next, then it's going to ask which file system format you want to use for the disk image. Now, this is different than the disk itself, remember, because this is just the thing that's going to mount. Again, you're going to want to pick something that's cross-platform. They recommend FAT because that's the most cross-compatible, but you can also choose XFAT if you want. So click next, and then it will ask you if you want to make this be a cross-platform volume, because that's what we want to do. You're going to want to pick that option, and finally click next. And then it's going to want to add some randomness to your key. It's going to ask you to move your mouse around, and you'll see a little bar going, and that's basically just generating random data that it's going to throw into the encryption keys, and that's going to increase the cryptographic strength, the strength of the keys and the cryptography, meaning that it's going to be harder to crack that encryption. So do that, and then you're going to click format, and then you will be done. It's going to create that encrypted disk image. Then the next step is going to be to actually mount that on your Mac or your PC, so you actually can put files onto that. And depending upon the size of the volume that you choose, just be prepared. If you have a large volume, something more than a few gigabytes, it's going to take quite a while to encrypt that volume. Encryption, strong encryption especially, takes a while to apply and to run, and it will do that, so be prepared to wait for a little bit. But once you've done that, then you can use Veracrypt to mount those containers or images, and then they'll show up just in your file system in the Finder, and you can copy files to them. You will have to use the Veracrypt software every time you want to mount that disk image. So the way it's going to work is you put the USB stick in there, you select the file from the Veracrypt app. So you'll launch the Veracrypt app, you'll select the file, and then you'll click mount. It will ask you to enter that password that you chose earlier. And then once mounted, it will appear as a standard volume in the Finder. It'll look just like a disk drive. And then you can copy or read write files from that volume. And then when you eject it, you just eject it like it was a normal hard disk, then that will be once again protected. Now, while it's mounted, just like the other core storage containers, it is sitting there unencrypted. So if you were to walk away from your Mac or something like that, and someone walked up to it and it hadn't gone to sleep, or you didn't have a password on your screensaver, someone would be able to get in and read that data. So it's not encrypting on the fly. It's actually sitting there decrypted anytime you've mounted it through the Veracrypt software. So to protect it, make sure that when you're done, you do eject that volume and you don't leave it, you know, sitting there open on your desktop, either on Mac or on Windows. And the last thing to note is that in order to use Veracrypt, you do need access to the admin account username and password, both on Mac or Windows, depending upon which platform you're on. So if you don't have that, you're not going to be able to use the Veracrypt software. So that's how I would do it, Alex. I know it sounds a little bit complicated, but it really isn't too bad. I did this on my own Mac and it worked out great. The only other thing I can think of is I do know that there are some hardware-based solutions out on the market. There are USB flash drives and disks that you can get that have encryption software kind of built into them. I don't know much about those, and I don't know that I have a recommendation for one of those, but maybe somebody in the community does. There's, you know, the USB keys that you can get where I think they even have fingerprint scanners on them to encrypt and decrypt the data that's on the drive. And I think they do have cross-platform versions of those. So that might be another thing that you look into. But I hope you find this information useful. If somebody else has a different way of doing this cross-platform, shoot us an email. Let me know, because this was really the only, Veracrypt was really the only solution that when I was Googling just kept popping up, at least for cross-platform encryption. So let us know, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing that I have for you for this week is a comment or a tip on using USB restricted mode on your iOS devices. This was something that was added as part of the iOS 11.4.1 update. And what this is when it's enabled, and it is enabled by default, it changes the security of your iOS device with respect to transferring data over the Lightning to USB cable. So when it's enabled, once your iOS device has been locked, without being unlocked for an hour, it will disable the Lightning port connection for anything other than charging. So you won't be able to do any data access over it. You won't be able to use any third-party USB accessories over the Lightning connector until you unlock the device again. So either with Face ID, Touch ID, or by entering the passcode. So if you were to have a device that had moved into USB restricted mode and you tried to, say, connect it to your Mac with the USB cable, it's going to ask you to authenticate and unlock the device before it's going to transfer any data or let you access any data on that device. So it's this added layer of security that will actually help protect you against some of the recent cracking tools, things like Graykey, that have surfaced that rely on that physical data connection or cable connection from the Lightning to the USB. And so Apple added this with iOS 11.4.1, and it is enabled by default. But if you want to change the settings, where you will find them is under Settings, under Face ID and Passcode, and then you want to scroll all the way to the bottom, and you will find a toggle for USB accessories, and that is the USB restricted mode setting. So you can toggle that off if you don't want to use this feature. I would recommend leaving it turned on. I don't think it's going to be that inconvenient for most people. I think it's fairly easy to unlock your device when you connect it with a USB, you know, with the Lightning cable. I've had mine on, I think, on my device for a while now, and I haven't noticed any issues with data, with it, you know, sort of inconveniencing me in day-to-day usage. So it is a toggle. You can toggle it on and off. And the only other thing to note is that apparently some third-party USB charging accessories might get impacted by this. So this may be, you know, if you have one of those kinds of accessories, this may be the scenario where you want to disable this feature, because if you're constantly just trying to use your USB charger and it's saying, well, I can't do it until you unlock your device, that might be inconvenient enough to want to disable it. The only other thing to know about USB restricted mode is you can engage it immediately if you use the emergency SOS feature on your phone. I would really recommend only using this in emergencies, because when you activate it, it will try to call emergency services like 911, and you don't want to just be calling 911 because you were trying to enable USB restricted mode. So if you are in an emergency, say someone's trying to steal your iPhone and you want to protect your data, what you can do is press and hold the side and volume buttons, not only protect your data, but immediately call emergency services, which is something you might want to do if you're being attacked or mugged or something like that. So you can press and hold the side button and the volume button on your phone, keep those pressed down, and it will automatically activate emergency SOS mode. You can also rapidly press the side button 5 times, and that will activate emergency SOS mode. And that will immediately set the USB restricted mode. It will also immediately disable Face ID and Touch ID. So you will have to enter your passcode to be able to access your device. And so that's USB restricted mode. That's how you use it. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great software. Get more information and details by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.